Hi, everyone, and welcome to a classic edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Ryan Dobson with our host, psychologist, and best-selling author, Dr. James Dobson. And I have to say, there are few joys in life that come close to the moment when you find out that you're about to have a little one for the very first time. Each child is a gift, and that mixture of joy and surprise, and I will add a little bit of fear for some, a lot of fear, is so exciting and for me totally overwhelming. The scariest part was when I looked at my little baby boy for the first time. Lincoln, they put him in my hands and I thought, oh my goodness, I'm responsible for keeping this kid alive? It is such a big responsibility and you have to get it right. Your child is not like a pet. I've got two dogs and I've got three chickens. I've had goats and all kinds of animals and the pressure is different. I love my animals and I want to protect them and take care of them, but it is totally different with children. You've got to get it right. And you have to get it right the first time. And to me, that idea is daunting. Some time ago, my dad invited three distinguished physicians, all with experience in pediatrics, to be with him to cover some of the top questions new parents ask. And that's what we're going to listen to today. If you combine their years of expertise, the doctors at this table represent nearly 100 years of medical experience. So I think their insights will be incredibly helpful. Dr. Marilyn Maxwell practices in Missouri, and she specializes in internal medicine and pediatrics. Dr. Paul Reiser is a family practitioner in California, and Dr. Patricia Francis specializes in pediatrics and also practices in California. So if you're a mom or a dad, get ready to take some notes. So let's start where we ought to in the beginning, right here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
We'll start at where it ought to begin, with right. The arrival of a new baby. It really is a kind of a scary time to raise children, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
It always is, and I think especially that first time up, you are so afraid of making a mistake, or what if the baby won't feed right, or what if she doesn't want to sleep tonight? Who's going to get any sleep around here? What are we going to do? These are things that just frighten the death out of new parents sometimes, and also adjusting to the idea for the very first time that you have a new human being that is totally dependent on you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That is a transition that is very, very difficult to make the first time.
Patty, let's suppose that you have been the physician for a newborn and you've seen them in the hospital and now the mother is taking that child home. What advice do you give?
I usually see them within 2 or 3 days after having gone home and I usually tell them, you will have lots of questions as soon as you leave here. And we expect that. And so I want to see you soon so I know you're okay. And I know the baby will be okay, but I want to make sure you're okay.
What do they ask you?
When they come in? Uh-huh. Well, is the baby getting enough to eat? Oh, the baby lost weight. Babies usually lose weight in the first, week, up to a week of life until the breast milk's established. Unless they're bottle feeding, then they lose weight for a shorter period of time. And they just don't know if everything's okay. They make all these snorts and grunts and sound moaning almost. And
don't sleep through the night.
Yeah, they're just nervous because they don't know what's normal.
And do you recommend breastfeeding?
I think it's the best choice, if at all possible. It supplies the baby with the perfect nutrition. And formula can substitute if need be, but if there's a choice, that would be the choice I would recommend.
There are other reasons, too, in terms of not only the biochemical composition, but the antibody composition, the likelihood of seeing that new baby back for some infectious problem is going to go way down. And it certainly has been that way in my office. And I think a lot of us kind of push breastfeeding a little bit harder than...
Maybe that's why God planned it that way.
Well, maybe it's because God designed it for human beings. And, I really encourage new moms to assume that will be the way they'll do it. I don't lay a guilt trip on them, of course, if they can't or they won't or whatever. But we really encourage new moms to take a very, very careful look at that decision if they're not thinking about doing it.
Marilyn, what are the danger signals in the first 3 months that you would tell a parent to watch for?
There are very subtle danger signals sometimes because a three-month-old, a baby, can't tell you what's wrong. They can't tell you if you just stuck him with the pin or if his stomach hurts. But if a baby is not feeding well, feeding normally, if the baby just isn't acting right. A mother's intuition is a very powerful
thing. So you believe that? When a mother calls
definitely.
And says something's not right.
If a mother calls and says, I don't know what is wrong, but my baby just doesn't look right.
Come on down.
I see that baby immediately. Mm. Also, if there's a fever, any fever in a baby under 3 months of age, a temperature of 100.4 or greater rectally, would be a concern that we would need to deal with.
How about croup? Every parent deals with that at some time or another. What do you tell them about croup? They call and they say, you know, my child's having trouble breathing. What do you say?
Usually it's in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And
always.
Yeah, you have to wake
after
yourself up.
After 11 p.m.
What seems to help a lot, first of all, is for the parents to stay calm, because the child or the infant gets anxious when they have this funny bark and they just can't seem to get air comfortably. And once the parent calms down and does some things, then the child frequently will calm down too. Going into the bathroom and shutting the door, turning the hot shower on and steaming the child up usually works.
You would not subscribe to the notion of telling parents to take two aspirin and call me in the morning. Then you do
not
recommend
easy.
That they get in touch with their physician mm-hmm. when there's something that's worrying them,
we
right?
We really do. And one of the things that we want to do is to educate parents about when those appropriate times are to call. Parents should never hesitate to call their physician.
Even in the middle of the night.
Even in the middle of the night if it is an emergency. And we want parents to know what those emergencies are.
Name them for us, Meryl.
So certainly, since we're talking about babies, a fever in a baby that is less than 3 months old is always an emergency and needs a call. A baby that is not a newborn baby, 2 to 3 months of age, that's not feeding right or not acting right, having excessive vomiting and diarrhea, not wetting diapers, those are things that they should call about.
Hmm. All right, let's move up the age range a little bit. Let's go to the six-month-old child. What are the symptoms that parents of that age need to be cognizant of?
I think anytime there's breathing difficulty, wheezing, croup, rapid breathing, anytime that the child's not comfortable, that's an immediate phone call.
Does appendicitis occur in a child that young?
It's uncommon. Unfortunately, when it does, it is often missed because the child can't tell you what's the matter. But it's not a real common event in young children or babies this age.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about child safety issues. I know that some of you care strongly about that. What advice do you give a parent about just taking basic safety precautions?
I think at 6 months, I go over with parents before the infant is crawling, have you started looking at your house? What about the plants that your infant can crawl up and play in the dirt, plugs that need to be plugged up, wires, anything that could cause an accident? You need to take care of that now. But if your infant or young toddler is more common, get into something that they shouldn't have gotten into, and they always put it in their mouth. That's a normal thing. That's an immediate phone call to find out, what do I do if you've discovered that?
And all parents should have the number of their local poison control posted.
Mm-hmm. And it's possible for parents to call the poison control center directly now. Mm-hmm. When I was at USC School of Medicine, only the physician could call. Now the parent can call, and you obviously take their advice. Whatever they tell you in that moment, you do.
You do it. Another big safety issue that we didn't mention is the car seat. Mm-hmm. And that really goes back to the trip home from the hospital. We're very concerned that every child, every trip, is in a car seat in the proper location.
Even for a newborn.
Especially for a newborn. A newborn needs to be placed in the back seat. In fact, all children really should be riding in the back seat mm-hmm. of an automobile, especially if there is an airbag on the passenger side. There's been a real concern over the increased number of serious injuries or even deaths to children, especially smaller children, from airbags in the passenger seat. And so one of the challenges of taking care of this new baby is that it takes sometimes more time to get them buckled into that seat than it does to do your trip. And you're sometimes tempted, if you're going to go down to the dry cleaner, to, we'll just kind of lay him here on the seat and let's not worry about all that car seat stuff. But most serious accidents take place within that few miles of home. Every time should be taken care of.
Other safety issues to consider, water safety issues. A child should never be left alone, even for a moment, to answer the phone, to run to the door for any reason in a bathtub, even if it's only an inch or two of water. Also, parents should check the temperature of their hot water heater. There have been many cases of babies being scalded and burned from the water being too hot. They're practical things. Every home should have a smoke detector. You know, that's a preventive measure. Hmm. Parents and patients sometimes look kind of strange when I mention things like that, and I try to explain to them this is prevention.
This is some great practical advice for the first years of your child's life here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. We'll continue the conversation in a moment, but first let me remind you that you can always find more parenting resources at drjamesdobson.org, including some of my dad's classic parenting books, The Strong-Willed Child, Dare to Discipline, Parenting Isn't for Cowards, and many others. So let's rejoin this panel of experienced doctors as they address a topic on the minds of most new moms and dads. I know it was for me, and that is SIDS. So here they are now on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
We have some good news because there's research now showing that not letting babies sleep on their stomach and even now on their side has dropped the incidence of SIDS. So we recommend all babies be put down on their backs to sleep at least up until 6 to 8 months. And that's dropped the incidence, which is encouraging.
I read a report the other day that probably links into that said that at least one of the causes may be that carbon dioxide is trapped in the covers with a baby's head perhaps buried in the covers, and it begins to rebreathe that, and it suppresses the breathing mechanism. Is that the position you all take?
I think that's been fairly well established and, in fact, has led to recommendations as to the kind of bedding you'd put a small child on. You don't put a little baby on a real poofy kind of a comforter. You don't want all kinds of paraphernalia in the crib. You want a bed mattress that's just real firm and can't possibly lead to that rebreathing episode. The other thing is cigarette smoke exposure has been clearly identified as a risk factor both before and after birth. There should be absolutely no cigarettes lit in the home of a new baby or a child, period.
Just today, I saw a report that indicated the mother, the pregnant woman who is smoking, delivers a baby with the same nicotine level in the baby's blood that she has in hers.
That's right.
And the baby needs to go through withdrawal in the first several days of life.
What a thing to put a baby through. Marilyn, you have strong feelings about that?
I have very strong feelings, not only with nicotine and cigarettes, but with alcohol, with drugs. These are things that babies will have to withdraw from, and they can damage a baby.
You have dealt with inner-city medicine in a hospital where you've treated a lot of 14, 15-year-old mothers who came in.
Yes.
Children having babies.
Children having children.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking. These are young children, not sure where they are in life, but yet having children and at that point having the responsibility of taking care of another life when they're not ready to take care of their own, and not understanding the importance of some of these issues, safety issues and other aspects of child rearing. In many of the cases with young single mothers, sometimes they will have the support of their mother or other family members. And thank goodness for some of the crisis pregnancy centers and other places where young teenage moms can get support. In addition, one of the issues that we address over and over again is we try to be very cognizant of single mothers. There are a lot of single mothers in some communities, particularly in inner cities. Half of the children born are more are two single moms, not just teenagers, but it's trendy, unfortunately, for even older professional women to have babies, non-marital births. So we encourage them that they need to have sources of support to get them through this difficult time.
You know, we buzzed pretty quickly past fetal alcohol syndrome. I hope that people listening to us will understand that that is a devastating thing for babies, that mental retardation and developmental problems and everything can come out of a fairly small amount of alcohol, apparently, in the first trimester.
Well, all the way through, it's a problem. And in fact, it doesn't take a constant drinking problem throughout the pregnancy to generate it. It can be related to some binging episodes as well. one of the things we really stress in this is that the parenting process, certainly for the mother and to some degree for a father too, starts before the birthday. That the way that a mother takes care of herself physically, with the abstinence from these various substances, but also good nutrition and exercise, and also her own personal spiritual preparations and psychological preparations, make a difference in the way she may approach this baby that's going to be a new responsibility for her.
You know, in the book of Judges, Judges 13:7, when Samson's mother was being told that she's carrying a very special child and that he had been anointed by God for a very important role, his mother was told not to drink wine or any other alcoholic beverage. And it's clear as you read that passage that the Lord understood the dangers of alcohol to an unborn child, and he was instructing Samson's mother by giving her some medical information that was not yet understood. I think that's a very interesting passage there.
In fact, a woman who is thinking about becoming pregnant, who might get pregnant, who maybe is working on that, should really think seriously about abstaining from all alcohol during that time frame, even when she's not pregnant.
Marilyn, what does it do to you to see a crack baby who is screaming in pain and torment for what his mother has ingested?
It's very troublesome. It's very concerning to see a baby have to suffer, to have to go through that, to try and fight through that because of what's been done to them ahead of time. And some mothers don't understand, or they are so addicted that, you know, it doesn't matter to them that they are harming their baby. But it's very disturbing to see that. And we see a lot of that in the inner city.
Patty, continuing to talk about safety issues, what about high chairs? Do you worry about children sitting in high chairs that they can crawl out and over and down?
Well, it happens all the time. I think a lot of it is the responsibility of the parent who's there to ensure that the high chair is a proper fit, that there's usually a safety strap in every high chair and needs to be used, and that when the infant is done and really getting squirmy, time to take them down and saying, we're done with this meal because you're throwing it on the floor.
You know, just in general with safety issues, you simply have to think ahead, don't you? Mm-hmm. Every moment of every day you have to think, is there anything in this environment? Is my child moving in any direction that could hurt him or her? Is there anything in the cabinet that that child could drink? Could they fall off of something? You've got to stay ahead of them for about 3 years or more, really, but certainly for the first 3 years.
More than that. And there's some things that parents don't think of because they're just common everyday items. Mouthwash. Babies can get terribly sick and have problems ingesting mouthwash because of the alcohol content in
aspirin it. Aspirin bottle.
Right. Aspirin, a terrible poisoning. Vitamins, children's vitamins with iron in them. That's one of the most frequent types of poisonings that we see in young children.
One of the hardest processes for a family to go through is to figure out how to make the environment safe at home without turning the whole place into a padded cell. Because you need to have an opportunity for a crawling baby or a baby who's starting to get mobile who wants to explore and feel and touch and handle everything. They want to have that opportunity and they need it. You can't just deal with your safety problem by taking a child and putting them in a playpen and patting them on the head and going away for a couple of hours. That baby needs the stimulation also. And there's it's a real tension between baby-proofing versus trying to make your child stay away from certain things at certain ages where they're really not capable of understanding what you want them to do.
One of the things that has concerned me for many years is that small children tend to get spanked or disciplined one way or another for doing nothing more than exploring their world, touching something that parent values. I mean, how does a child know that china cup is something that he or she shouldn't touch?
They don't know Wedgwood from Wendy's, especially starting at around 8 or 9 months. There is this insatiable curiosity that needs to be satisfied. And going through those last few months of the first year and into the one-year-old age group, that child really isn't defying you when he goes up to that interesting thing for the seventh time. He's just too interested and his memory's too short, and you have to use a little bit of common sense to decide when it's time to take some disciplinary action, which is really more designed to protect him and to avoid the constant torrent of no's and don't touch that and get away from this and don't pick that up that can really become a real problem.
What would you recommend in terms of a schedule of when the physician should see the child, beginning at birth, how often, and then how does it trail off from there?
Well, the Academy of Pediatrics has a recommended schedule, which we use plus or minus depending on problems. I usually see families early on, as I mentioned, in the first several days, and then at 2 weeks, at 1 month of age, 2 months of age, and then every 2 months through up till 6 months, because immunizations are given at those times, then usually a 9-month visit and a 1-year visit. So pretty frequently.
Okay, in the second year, Marilyn?
In the second year, they're seen at a year of age, at 15 months, 18 months, and then parents finally get a break. They get a 6-month break for the first time.
Assuming there's no problem.
Assuming there's no problems, are seen at 24 months.
We were talking about the dangers of water earlier. I want to just come back to that for one moment. You should not leave a child in a tub without your being there.
That's
correct. A child can drown in 1 inch of water.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So you should not turn your back, even in a tub, when they're playing with little duckies and things.
That's
right.
Ever. And another thing to look out for, just like a little bucket of suds that you're cleaning up with, or even just the open toilet. A toddler can actually topple into an open toilet. And these are all things that you wouldn't think of as hazards around the house, but that have to be looked out for.
And one of the reasons for that, the head size of a toddler is larger than the rest of his body in proportion, so they are more top-heavy and they're more likely to topple over and lose their balance.
You know, we see a lot of young toddlers who get burns, whether it be from mom's hot cup of coffee or a charcoal that flew out of the barbecue, a curling iron, an iron falling down. There's a lot of hazards that can cause burns that it's amazing how frequently that comes up.
Speaking of trips to emergency hospitals, parents are skittish today for fear that they'll be accused of child abuse when they bring in a child with a bruise or a burn. Talk about that. I mean, you know, that there's a legitimate concern on both sides of that issue.
There is a legitimate concern, but healthcare workers, doctors, nurses that routinely work with children understand a particular pattern that we tend to see. Nothing is foolproof, but that we tend to see with child abuse. They're very characteristic types of injuries, and then they're very characteristic types of injuries that happen with normal falls, or we would be concerned if the story was not consistent with the injuries that we would see on the child.
I think if a parent, too, has had something happen that happened, and it would be better for them even to take the risk of getting a little bit of investigation if they know nothing has been done wrong, so that the care is given properly.
So they raise the issue themselves and explain this was a legitimate injury. Would you recommend they bring that out in the open?
I think that the most important thing is to be very forthright about what happened. One of the signs that you look for in child abuse is an evasive, funny story that doesn't make any sense. And if you tell a story, and even if you made a mistake and turned your back 1 second too long and an accident happened, better to say it, gee, I just turned around too long and this happened, than to make up some crazy story that will sound like an abusive parent.
Patty, you see child abuse?
I see the issue raised a lot. And I was just thinking, so many children now are in daycare that a lot of the times parents will bring in their child wondering, what is this mark? Or I didn't know about this bruise. And they don't know what happened in the childcare. Nobody told them that there was a fall. And so the issue comes up a lot. And most of the time, fortunately, it turns out there was a fall and the childcare just forgot to tell them. But the question gets asked in this day and age frequently.
We're going to break in right here on part one of Parenting Basics, the first year here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Ryan Dobson, and I hope everyone listening has found at least a nugget or two of great advice on today's broadcast. Our panel includes several distinguished medical professionals, Dr. Paul Reiser, Dr. Marilyn Maxwell, and Dr. Patricia Francis. This panel represents nearly 100 years of medical expertise, and that is pretty incredible. And we hope what they've had to say today will be helpful to parents everywhere. This kind of practical advice is at the heart of what we do here at Family Talk. We have so many resources available on parenting and the family on our website. That's drjamesdobson.org. And I want to mention a few of these today. My dad, of course, has written several books on parenting, three of which include Dare to Discipline, The Strong-Willed Child, and Parenting Isn't for Cowards. And if you'd like to pick up a copy of one or all three of these books, you can visit our website, again, drjamesdobson.org, or call us at 877-732-6825. And when you contact us, consider donating to our work here at Family Talk. We make it our mission to collect the best information possible for families to prosper. The mission of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk is to promote the institution of the family and the biblical principles on which it's based, while simultaneously introducing as many people as possible to the gospel of Jesus Christ. But to do that, we need your help. Your generous support opens the door for us to help families and proclaim Jesus Christ to a broken culture. You can donate on our website, drjamesdobson.org, by calling us at 877-732-6825, on our Facebook page, or through our Family Talk app. Thanks for your support, and don't miss the second part of Parenting Basics next time on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
Family Talk is not affiliated with Focus on the Family.